Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight where Geoffrey Gray makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He spoke here quite a few years ago in his book on confrontasi or confrontation, and more recently he joined Tim Fisher in discussing Sir John Monash. I'll introduce him briefly. Geoffrey Gray is Professor of History and the Founding Director of the Australian Centre for the Study of Armed Conflict and Society at the University of New South Wales in Canberra. He's the author or editor of numerous books and articles, and he held the Major General Matthew C. Horner Chair in Military Theory at the Marine Corps at the University in Quantico, and served as a trustee of the Society of Military History. And his books are many, but they include A Military History of Australia, A History of the Australian Army, A History of the Navy in Southeast Asia from the mid-50s to the early 70s, and A History on the Korean War. But tonight, Geoffrey Gray is going to talk for us on the publication of his most recent book, A Soldier's Soldier, a biography of Lieutenant General Sir John Daly. And that's the topic for tonight, and the actual title of the talk I forget, but it's... What is it tonight?
Sir Thomas Daly and the Australian Army in an Age of Continuous
Commitments. Sir Geoffrey Gray, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard. It's a great pleasure to be at the Sydney Institute again after a spell of some years. And it's a great pleasure to address this gathering. I've always enjoyed my forays up here for this purpose. So thank you for inviting me and for welcoming me. Biography is a difficult and exacting form of historical writing. It's much harder to do effectively than perhaps it looks. I think every serious historian should try their hand at it, for it provides wonderful instruction in humility and the limits of the possible. In contrast to both the United Kingdom and the United States, not many public officials in this country write their memoirs, nor, I find, do many keep personal papers. Daly was no exception, and I was lucky that he had willingly submitted to interview with a number of historians, including myself, during his long retirement, and that these interviews were all more or less accessible. Creating a picture of what happened is relatively easy. Explaining why it happened and why it matters is something else entirely. I want to start by telling three stories, or perhaps by painting three short word portraits, to illustrate something about the historical continuities that have always existed for the Army, even in times of major military effort. All three involve Tom Daly at different stages of his long and eventful career. The first involved the preparations of the 2nd 10th Battalion before the Balikpapan landings in Borneo in July 1945. Daly took over as commanding officer in late 1944 with the task of reorienting the battalion for an opposed amphibious operation after a lengthy period spent fighting in the close country of New Guinea. Daly was well aware of the problems that such an operation presented and based his training program to take account of the difficulties faced by the US Marines in the early amphibious assaults in the Central Pacific in 1943-44, in which they had suffered often heavy casualties through being held up on the beaches by the Japanese defences. The first time Daly's soldiers actually saw a landing ship tank, the amphibious vessels with which they would make the assault, was when they boarded them at Redlinch for passage to Moratai and onwards voyage to Balikpapan itself. During the 8-month workup phase, before this, they practised embarking and disembarking using chalk outlines on the pavement. The second took place more than a decade later. By 1959, Daly was in the middle of his term as General Officer Commanding Northern Command, which was what they used to call Queensland in those days, in the rank of Major General. And in that year was tasked by the CGS, Lieutenant General Sir Ragnar Garrett, was conducting an exercise, designated Grand Slam, in central Queensland that would bring together the regular battalions of the Army's first and only infantry brigade, then scattered between Inaugura, Singleton and Puckapunyal. It was designed to put both the brigade and battalion headquarters through their paces, but apart from concentrating the units concerned, was conducted in the parsimonious manner usual in the 1950s, and indeed beyond. As Daly's senior staff officer, Lieutenant Colonel Derek Sharp, later recalled for me, there was artillery participation, but no armour, no tanks, even though the exercise plan had specifically called for it and had been endorsed by higher authority. Derek went on, one day when Tom was due to arrive at exercise headquarters a few days before the action started, I got hold of a 12-year-old boy from a nearby farm, and between us we dressed his billy cart up to look like a tank. At an appropriate moment, this tank rattled past Tom, who was standing with a group of us beside the road, looking at maps and air photographs, with the young driver waving and shouting, "I'm a tank! I'm a tank!" Those of us who knew Tom well knew that the angrier he became, the quieter his voice became. On this occasion, he turned to me and in nothing more than a whisper said, "Get rid of that thing, Sharp." The third incident concerned the preparation of the early battalions readied for service in Vietnam in 1966-67, by which time Daly was a relatively newly appointed CGS himself. The bloody-minded non-cooperation of the Royal Australian Air Force in this matter is well documented. Despite the fact that the new Iroquois troop carriers had been acquired by the government in 1964 specifically for the purpose of cooperation with the Army, the Air Force and successive chiefs of the Air Staff specifically declined repeated requests for the use of the aircraft in the training cycle. When 1RAR arrived in Vietnam in mid-1965, the soldiers had never practiced embarking and disembarking with the actual aircraft the Americans deployed in such abundance. The following year, 7RAR, preparing for deployment to Vietnam in April 1967, was forced to use chalk outlines of aircraft once again in order to familiarise the soldiers with procedures and skills they needed to acquire. Some things don't change. The Australian Army in particular is very familiar with the economic cycle of boom and bust that characterises defence spending in liberal democracies, and is equally familiar with the consequences that almost invariably flow from this. Across an army career that spanned 41 years, from staff cadet to chief of the general staff, Lieutenant General Sir Thomas Daly, as he became, acquired plenty of experience of both. Daly joined the army and entered RMC Duntroon at the beginning of 1930, just as the worst effects of the Great Depression began to bite hard. In his second year at the college, RMC was moved to Sydney, and the Canberra facility closed as an economy measure. But contrary to popular belief, the Army had been starved of resources for a decade already, following heavy reductions in the defence budget in 1922. Any minor gains the Army achieved by the late 1920s as a result of a defence development programme whose main beneficiary was the Royal Australian Navy were wiped out in the further reduction of the early 1930s. Daly wondered whether he'd made a wise choice of career, but his first preference to read medicine at the University of Melbourne had been ruled out because of the cost. His father earned just too much to qualify for a bursary, but not enough to actually be able to afford him to be a full-time student in residence in Melbourne. Pay and conditions languished, but for young regular officers there were at least limited opportunities for professional and practical development. As assistant adjutant of a militia light horse regiment scattered across rural western Victoria and South Australia, he virtually ran the unit on a day-to-day basis. In 1938-39, he went to India on attachment to a succession of British cavalry regiments, valuable not least for the exposure to mechanisation that the British mounted arm was then undergoing, and a process that had stalled in Australia for lack of resources. The army that went to war in September 1939 was less capable than, and equipped almost identically too, the one that had returned from the Great War in 1919. Daly's experience in staff and administrative roles led to his appointment as adjutant of an infantry battalion, the 2nd 10th as it happens, and then as brigade major of the 18th Brigade. He had a very fortunate war in many respects. The indisposition of the brigade commander, George Wootton, meant that Daly virtually commanded the brigade attack, its first brigade attack, on Italian fortified positions at Jarabub, while his months in Tobruk during the siege honed his understanding of both defensive tactics and the realities and limitations of modern mechanized combat. A succession of increasingly senior staff positions in North Africa and then in New Guinea culminated in command of the 2nd 10th Battalion for the assault at Balikpapan, the largest amphibious operation ever undertaken, at least to date, by the Australian Army. At the time of his appointment in late 1944, he was also the only regular officer in command of an infantry battalion of the 2nd AIF. After the war, he made good the deficiencies in his theoretical military education with courses in the United Kingdom, where high-flying Australian officers were sent to gain perspectives that our own small and intellectually cramped environment could not provide, and again exercised command at the brigade level in Korea in his own right on this occasion. The decade or more between the end of the Korean War and the commitment to Vietnam from 1965 was a lean and difficult one for the Army again. The National Service Scheme, introduced in 1951 for politico-cultural reasons, had no overseas service obligation, added nothing to capability, and distorted the Army's budget and force structure. Korea was fought by an army that was structured, trained, and largely equipped along the lines of the Second World War, and by the mid-1950s, this was largely obsolescent. Technological solutions were believed to hold the key both to survival on what some assumed would be an atomic battlefield, and to reducing defence outlays through reductions in personnel while increasing firepower. Survivability and lethality were to be acquired, in the Australian Army's case, through a radical new organisational structure, the Pentropic Division. This was modelled on the US Pentomic structure and reflected a belief that with an anticipated British withdrawal from east of Suez, the Australian forces would need to operate along American lines in order to partner effectively with their US counterparts. Unfortunately, the US Army abandoned it, just as we implemented it. The habitual closeness of relations between the US and Australian armed forces that we now take largely for granted, I think, did not exist in the 1950s. And no one else used it, which was a problem while we continued to operate in Malaya and Malaysia as part of an integrated Commonwealth Brigade. The restructuring of the Army in Australia led to the wholesale collapsing of CMF units, many with long lineages and deep roots in local communities, which remains, I suggest, a malign legacy within the Army Reserve to this day. The one positive was that it enabled a substantial modernisation and re-equipping of the regular Army that was substantially overdue. Daly noted of the commitment to Vietnam, and I quote him, "The Army wasn't prepared for this kind of commitment. It never is. It wasn't prepared for Korea, but the Army has to do these things when the government wants them to do it." Nor, despite the fact that the first regular battalion to be sent to Vietnam was based in his command, by now New South Wales, was Daly apprised of the move until it had actually been decided. Nor indeed did the Defence Committee, which comprised the service chiefs, the Secretary and the Minister for Defence, discuss the Vietnam commitment at all until April 1965, the point at which it was actually made. The initial commitment strained the organisation, and subsequent increases and expansion of the force were piecemeal and episodic. Rather than creating a balanced force with a rational force structure and committing it to war, the Army was forced to cannibalise other parts of its establishment in order to meet the needs of the task force in Phuc Thuy province. It had been forced to sustain the 2-battalion commitment to the Korean War in 1952-53 on the same improvised basis. In both cases, the fielding of a self-contained force was simply beyond the Army's means, at least initially. Historically, I would argue, the Army has embarked upon wars from a very low base of preparedness and built from there. In 1914, the system that had been put in place to generate an army when needed was found unsuited to the task and had to be abandoned and replaced by a different model from scratch. After the war, a committee of senior generals produced a plan for the future needs of the army at ministerial direction, only to see it shelved with the budget reductions of the early 1920s. The outline plan 401, drafted in great haste in 1922 in the face of the Chanak crisis, was shelved and then dusted off in 1939 and formed the basis for the initial expeditionary force dispatched at the end of that year to the Middle East, but the raising and sustaining of forces both in Australia and overseas was improvised once again, with considerable attendant waste, and only supplanted by a rational, and as it happens, smaller force structure from late 1943. As in 1918, by 1945, Australia possessed land forces of proven capacity able to carry out government policy effectively and efficiently. As in 1918, so in 1945, these forces were quickly dismantled at war's end and reduced drastically in size, which was entirely justified, and in capability, which was not. The post-war occupation of Japan required the maintenance of a skeleton organisation, which, once again, had to be rapidly augmented in 1950 to meet the needs of Korea. Even before the final withdrawal of troops from Vietnam in 1971, the government was looking at reductions in the army's establishment in the face of considered professional advice from Daley and others. Although he was long retired by then, the 1980s and early 1990s saw the progressive degradation of the army in terms both of strength and capability, such that when the need to intervene in East Timor emerged from a clear blue sky in the second half of 1999, the army was only just able to meet the tasks which government gave it. It is not, I think, an exaggeration to say that had any part of the Indonesian military establishment sought to seriously contest the Australian intervention, there would not have been a great deal we could have done about it. And now, as we comprehend the end of a decade plus of overseas deployments and a high operational tempo, with the completion of the drawdown from Afghanistan sometime in 2014, we seem fated to repeat the cycle at precisely the point where, through considerable expenditure of resources, we have fashioned an army once again capable of giving effective expression to government policy. The army of Daley's time and that of our own day are very different organisations in many key respects. One thing they share in common for the time being is the experience of a protracted conflict that was and is poorly understood by the electorate, with whom the political level has generally failed to engage in explaining what our forces are doing and why. In other respects, comparisons between the Vietnam War and either of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are, I think, generally fatuous and often wrong. In few, if any, matters are there any real points of commonality or meaningful comparison. The political climate in Australia is very different today from what it was in the late 1960s and early 1970s, and popular attitudes to the military bear no comparison. In some ways, precisely because of a particular reading of the treatment accorded to Australian soldiers in Vietnam and after their return. Daley was intensely frustrated by the apparent refusal of the government to defend the army in the face of often vitriolic public criticism. His view of the press, though not necessarily of individual journalists, became increasingly jaundiced across his time as CGS. On one occasion after the Tet Offensive was launched in early 1968, he described, and I quote because it's too good not to, the lunatic hallucinations of the Daley press which have achieved transcendental levels in the past week. He was even more appalled by the dishonest and misleading reportage of what became the Civic Action Affair, or the Civic Action Crisis as it's sometimes called, in March 1971, and which resulted in the fall of the Prime Minister, John Gorton, and significant political damage, for a time, to the Minister for Defence, Malcolm Fraser. The hostility and machinations directed at Gorton by certain members of the press gallery have few more recent parallels, at least in this country. Daley tried hard to keep the army out of it, aided by the fact that he neither courted the press, nor, in almost any circumstances, did he brief off the record. The growing unpopularity of national service was a partial explanation for the increasingly tense relations between the senior ranks of the army, who, it should be remembered, had opposed its reintroduction in 1964, and the government, which was, in Daley's view, and I quote him again, extraordinarily sensitive to any kind of criticism of the administration of the army that affected national servicemen. But it went well beyond this, perhaps understandably, the sensitivity to domestic opinion in a climate where the government seemed increasingly beleaguered. Daley mostly declined requests to speak or write on the army's role in Vietnam after 1967, following a request that some remarks he had prepared be cleared with the Prime Minister, no less, Harold Holt. It is not for service officers to engage in public controversy, he acknowledged. But the unwillingness at the political level to defend the army and its conduct of operations in Vietnam meant that the argument went by default. Over the years, he later reflected, the army has become conditioned to not talking to anybody. It bears repeating that the army of today is in many respects a very different entity from that of the 1960s, much less the 1930s when Daley first entered it. There are recurrent themes in our military history, as well as continuities and ruptures. The greater centralisation of defence policy and functions, and the greatly enhanced authority of the Minister and the Secretary of Defence, which occurred basically after Daley's retirement, have brought benefits, but have not precluded the sorts of inter-service rivalries and arguments over budgets, roles and responsibilities and equipment programmes that were a common feature of the sector in the 1950s and 1960s, and again, indeed, in the 1920s and 1930s. The role of the Chief of the Defence Force as the principal uniformed advisor to government is vastly expanded over the situation in which Daley could describe its precursor as, I quote, not a position of power, a token uniform within the system. But some of the issues and problems would strike him as very familiar. The continuing search for a realistic role for and expectations of the Army Reserve, issues of pay and conditions, separations for service families and the churn of the posting cycle and overseas deployments, and the costs in all senses of remote basing of substantial parts of the army around Australia for essentially political or electoral reasons. Daley retired from the army in 1971 and went on to make a major contribution to the modernisation and professionalisation of another major national institution, the Australian War Memorial, as a widely respected and admired chairman of the council. He'd been an ex officio member as Chief of the General Staff, a system which still pertains to this day. All three of the service chiefs sit ex officio on the council, which doubtless gave him awareness of its problems. And as chairman, he successfully advocated to government for increased budgets and staffing as part of a process of bringing its practices into line with contemporary museum and archival practice. He held a small number of directorships and maintained links with the army through a succession of regimental colonelcies, as a trustee of the Infantry Corps Museum, and through his quiet influence and undoubted authority as one of the most distinguished chiefs of the post-war era. Let me conclude where I began with biography and some borrowed observations on it. Reviewing a recent biography of Karl Marx in the pages of New Republic recently, probably the only circumstances in which Tom Daley and Karl Marx will be mentioned in the same sentence, Peter Gordon observed a biography as an historical genre that biographies come of two kinds. The first, and more conventional kind, portrays the hero as an exception, a genius, or a rebel against his time. We are all familiar with the exceptional biography because it has been and remains the most popular genre on the market, alongside that other study of the dead, the murder mystery. The academic biographer, on the other hand, like the logician, loathes the exception. One cannot leap out of one's own time. So even the rebel only rebels in the ways his time allows. The second kind of biography does away with all talk of unique gifts. Where the first lionises, the second historicises. It shows the protagonist as a specimen of his age. The payoff here is complicated. Historical instruction, obviously. But underneath the respectable goal of learning about the past, we read an exemplary biography also because it unties us from that past. Its covert message is that the dead have no claim upon the living. The hero belongs to his time, not to ours. I think and I hope I fall somewhere between those two stools. Daley avowedly belonged to his time, and his time is not ours, even if it resonates with us. I would argue that it is the very fact of that resonance that continues to make the study of history in all its forms of continuing value in our own times. Or as Gordon says elsewhere in the review just cited, historians are faced with a special challenge in an accelerating society that dispenses with the past like a used paper cup. All things are evanescent, but that does not make them obsolete. Thank you very much.
Many thanks, Geoffrey. And as I said, Diana Grundy's got some copies of A Soldier, Soldier, a biography of Lieutenant General Sir Thomas Daley. And it's great to see Peter Lay here tonight, who's the former Chief of Army and who addressed us in the past, but it's good to see him in the audience tonight. So we come to questions and discussion. We've got plenty of time, and there are a lot of areas we can cover. Can I just start off talking about Thomas Daly himself? He's born to a Catholic family. He spends 1 year at, I think, the final year at Xavier College in Melbourne, and from correspondence that I've seen, he was quite sort of, he regarded that as an important year in his life. There's a photograph in the book of him in a rowing crew. He marries in the Xavier College chapel, and he dies in a requiem at the requiems at St. Mary's Cathedral here in Sydney. So obviously he's a man who's a lifelong Catholic, but what was that important to him? And if it was important to him, how did that affect his life in the period after the First World War of the 1920s and the 1930s, when anti-Catholic sectarianism was still around in Australia? It's sort of dying out as the Second World War commences. Just tell us a bit about his personal background.
His Catholicism was tremendously important to him. Tremendously important. One of the things, stories I tell in the last part of the book, after his retirement, he lived up here in Sydney for many years, and he used to volunteer at the Matthew Talbot Hostel several times a week. And when people asked who he was, he'd just say, "Brother Tom." There's a lovely story which his confessor figure, Monsignor Eugene Harley, who some of you may know in the Mossman Parish, tells. One time at the hostel, Tom was there washing and serving food and so on, and there was a young woman there who was also volunteering, and they got talking, and it turned out she came from Mossman, from the parish. And as they were finishing up, he said, "Oh, please give my regards to your parish priest." And she said, "Oh, of course, but how do you know him?" "Oh," he said simply, "we served in the army together."
Right, so we go to... we're in a sense of... Here we go. Don't stand in front of the camera. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
If Tom and the army opposed selective conscription in 64-65, what was the army's answer to an army without conscription? And what was the political motivation for insisting on conscription?
Could you just repeat a bit of that question?
Sure. The question was concerning the opposing of the introduction of national service by the army in the early 60s and why it was nonetheless prevailed. The army had been asked about national service a couple of times in the early 1960s. People now think or believe that it was introduced for Vietnam. It wasn't. When it was introduced in November 1964, we hadn't made any infantry battalion commitments to Vietnam. It hadn't, as I've said in my remarks, even been discussed. We were very conscious of a highly complex security situation in the region. We were deeply enmeshed in confrontasi with Indonesia, in Malaysia. We were very, very apprehensive that the Indonesians might decide to open a second front, as it were, and spill across the border into Papua New Guinea. People now forget that we had direct defence responsibility for PNG, and so that would have been a very, very serious expansion of that conflict. Vietnam was there. We had advisors, but we hadn't made any decision about sending battalions or a task force or anything in there. So it wasn't introduced specifically for Vietnam service, despite what's sometimes claimed. The army had been asked a couple of times about how it might meet essentially the manpower shortfall, given this series of potential multiple simultaneous commitments around the region. And it always came back and said improved pay and conditions. Pay and conditions in the army through the 50s and the early 60s were pretty shocking. I'm an army brat. I can remember living in successive 10.5 square temporary married quarters that had been put up sometime around 1943 to 44, and by 1965 had not had a cent spent on their maintenance since. It wasn't an attractive option. Again, remembering, you know, fairly prosperous, as a generalisation, fairly prosperous economic time with reasonably full employment. Government didn't want to do that. Ultimately, the reason they introduced conscription in 64 is because it was cheaper than improving pay and conditions and attracting more regulars.
Okay, just going back on my earlier question, did he experience any Catholic sectarianism at all, being such a strong Catholic?
I don't know.
No record of that?
He never said anything about it, and there's no record of it.
Okay.
He seems to have had an extremely happy and contented childhood.
Gee, that's unusual these days. Right, so as everyone's warming up, can I take you back to probably the most controversial part, politically controversial part of his life, which was the argument that involved the Prime Minister, John Gorton, Thomas Daley, the Minister, Defence Minister, Army Minister Malcolm Fraser, Defence Minister Andrew Peacock.
Andrew Peacock Army.
Other way. And Fraser Defence, Andrew Peacock Army, and the journalist Grumpy Alan Ramsey. So, and Ramsey gets up and accuses the Prime Minister of being a liar from the press gallery on the basis of what Gorton had said about a conversation he had with Daley. Can you just fill us in on that? Because that's a kind of issue where Daley becomes not just an army figure, but someone who inadvertently probably is involved in a controversial Australian political issue.
You've got to remember that Gorton was deeply detested by some sections of his own party. If you read Peter Howson's diaries, I'm sure many of you have, he records the bubbling away of conspiracy against Gorton while he was Minister for Air and afterwards. There were sections of his own party that were never reconciled to Gorton as Prime Minister. Now, Fraser was not one of them. And Daley always said afterwards, he never for the life of him, to the day he died, could understand where this whole mess had come from. I think in part it was a product of Fraser's character and personality. Daley had known him when he was Minister for the Army at the beginning of the Vietnam commitment, and they'd gotten on quite well. Fraser tended to be very demanding. He wanted reams and reams and reams of information, whether it was relevant, whether it fell within a ministerial requirement or responsibility or not. Sorry?
Yeah. Okay, come on. No, go on.
And when he became Minister for Defence, one of the things that he carried over from his time as Minister for the Army was what I suppose these days we'd call the feel-good story of civic action, which was basically getting out there and providing clean water supplies to villages and improved strains of rice for the crops and those sorts of nation-building security enhancement things that our people have been doing in other places more recently. And he would often put out regular press releases pointing to Australian civic action activities in Phuc Thuy and distributed them very widely. So he had a personal interest which was long-standing. Somewhere along the line, he got the idea from a garbled press report that the army was going to shut down civic action. Now, this is late 1970. We all know that we're leaving. We're leaving because the Americans are leaving. The Americans have said that and so have we. We've already started that process. And in the army staff headquarters in Saigon and in Phuc Thuy province, they very sensibly said, well, there's no point in starting major projects now that we're not going to be here to see through to fruition. That's just embarrassing for the Australian government and it does nothing to help the local people. So let's start managing this in a phased, sensible way so that we can hand over as much as we can to the local authorities in ways that are sustainable. Somehow that got garbled back in Australia to the army's not keen on civic action, they're going to shut it down. Fraser then appears to have expressed his disgruntlement in a number of quarters in the media. He was well known for providing off-the-record briefings. These, in turn, were not always reported then with quite the emphasis or spin that he had put upon them or had thought he'd put upon them. There were some mad stories about the Joint Intelligence Organisation being used to spy on the army in Phuc Thuy, and it just started to build ahead of steam. When you layered that over the frustration that Daley and many of his seniors were feeling about the perceived lack of public support for the army in Vietnam in the face of the moratoriums, demonstrations, criticism within and outside Parliament and in the media, you had a fairly potent mix brewing. And in a combination that nobody could control or had predicted, Gorton decided to buy into this. His relations with Fraser seem to be uneasy by this stage, although there's no specific incident that anybody's ever pointed to explain why the relationship broke down. And he asked Daly to come over and see him in the context of all these reports, lurid reports in the newspapers. Now, this was unusual, not exactly not done, but unusual at the time. Normally, if the Prime Minister wanted to see one of the service chief would make an appointment and bring his minister with him, remembering that there were separate ministers for each of the services plus a defence minister. At this time, Andrew Peacock is in hospital for surgery, Malcolm Fraser's gone home for the weekend, and in an age before internet and mobile phones can't be contacted, and the Prime Minister has requested the Chief of the General Staff to come across and see him. That's not something you say, look, can it wait till next week? So he goes across and they have a conversation. To the best of my researches and other people's, no record of that conversation was taken or survived. Alan Ramsay, by means that to this day he has declined to disclose, which is his business, got it into his head and reported that Daly had charged Fraser with disloyalty to the army in conversation with the Prime Minister. And when Ramsay had properly checked this with Gorton, Gorton had refused to confirm or deny a private conversation between two individuals, which, again, was pretty much the sort of form that you'd have expected at the time. Ramsay decided that meant, yes, it had actually been said, and so he went to print. And from there, the whole thing simply spiralled out of control. Daly did his best to keep, and fairly successfully, to keep the army out of it. It really wasn't about the army. It was about the frustrations and ill will and whatever going on within the Liberal Party and the Liberal government at that time. And I'm just about old enough to remember how dysfunctional government was reported as being around that period between late Gorton and through McMahon's prime ministerships. The sense within the party of a long period in office, perhaps appearing to be coming to an end sooner rather than later, the frustrations of the war, all of this came together to produce a quite extraordinary period of no more than about 10 days, which ultimately resulted in the Prime Minister casting the ballot against himself in the party room, Malcolm Fraser taking himself off to the back benches, and everybody wondering what on earth that had all been about.
Good question. Yes, question here. Yeah.
It's true that Vietnam was a nightmare for those who were governing, and it was an absolute picnic for the press. You mentioned the Tet Offensive, which, as I understand it, was a completely distorted account in the media from what actually happened, and Daly was obviously shocked and horrified. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? You know, how it was distorted and why it was distorted?
Okay, well, distortion, of course, is in the eye of the beholder. What you've got to remember is, again, some of the physical, technological limitations of press reporting at the time. No Australian news bureau kept permanent representatives in Saigon. They were mostly based in Singapore. They'd pop up for a week or so, cover some stuff, and come back. Whether you were sending footage back to Australia or to the United States for broadcast on the evening news, it was usually about 2 days between the time of the events and their going to air. So there was always this prolonged time lag in which things could gain a momentum of their own. There's a very very good book, and I'm just going to forget the name of the author, which talks about the reporting of Tet in the United States media in 1968, and which goes into these sorts of issues at great length. The problem was that even when it became known, for example, probably the biggest story of the immediate outbreak of the Tet Offensive was the sapper teams breaking into the compound of the US Embassy in Saigon. Now, fact is, they didn't get into the inner sanctums, they didn't breach the buildings, and they were all killed within a matter of hours by the security forces inside the compound. As attacks go, it was a spectacular failure in every dimension except its reportage. But even when it was known that in fact had been the outcome, television, as we all know, being an intensely visual medium, requires pictures. And the only pictures they had were from the opening couple of days of the Tet Offensive, when it seemed that every major urban and provincial centre in the country was under attack, which was pretty much the case for a short period of time. As I say, distortion, yes indeed, but not necessarily a conscious or manipulative effort. In this particular study of Tet and in a couple of others, Bill Hammond, for example, has done, he shows that if you go through and analyse the print media coverage in the United States, until very late in the war, it's majority supportive. You can always point to the odd high-profile individual who perhaps came out early or likes to remember with advantages later that they came out early in opposition. But if you actually go back and look at the thing as it was, the reality belies some of the mythology.
Okay, there's a question here. Yeah.
How would you rate Tom Daley as a strategist?
Not a question you can answer because he never practiced it. The job for the chiefs of the services was not strategy. Jim Molan, who some of you may know or have read, argues that in the Australian context, the uniformed services aren't allowed to practice strategy. That's reserved to the political level. And I think there is something to what he says. And I think it's historically true. The only senior Australian officer who has ever really practiced the strategic art was Tom Blamey. Not Monash, who never functioned at that level. It was Blamey and Blamey alone.
In the Second World War? The Pacific War?
Yes.
Peter Lay.
Jeff, thank you for a very clear and informative talk. You spoke of boom and bust and peacekeeping commitments and continuity. All absolutely true. The issue of strategic culture, we saw the strategic culture after Blaine's, after Davies' time, become really the counterpoint between expeditionary operations and defence of Australia. It's almost become a philosophy. What was his experience during the time of his career? Was it the same strategic culture, the counterpoints between these two?
So it was the question about the expeditionary culture and the defence of Australia culture. Yeah.
That's an argument that I think has characterised the Australian defence debate since not long after Federation. And indeed, you can probably find some examples even further back. But when James Whiteside Mackay was Minister for Defence in about 1911, I think, maybe a little bit earlier, about 1907, he talks there about the anywhere and everywhere argument. Were you defending Australia's interests anywhere they were threatened or everywhere they were threatened? Was it about the defence of Australian territory, in other words, or about the defence of the national interests? And that's an argument that has swung back and forth, I think, in defence policy in this country since before the First World War. And it's they're good questions. They're not silly questions. We may not always get the answers that I think we should, or the balance is right, but that particular argument about the defence of Australian territory versus the defence of the national interest is a very necessary one to have. And Daley certainly experienced that as well, particularly in the 1950s.
Experienced in what way?
Well, the whole argument about what was the army for? You bring in a national service scheme in 1950, but it has no commitment for overseas service. So what does it actually do? At a time when everybody agrees in the Cold War and with an enunciated policy of forward defence, that the defence of Australian territory, which is the only place that those national servicemen can ever be called upon to fight, is the least likely outcome of any of those that can reasonably be foreseen.
There's a question here.
Did he ever express, to you or in writing, about which generals he admired, either in history or Westmoreland or Alexander the Great or Napoleon? Did he have an opinion on what was a good general?
I've never come across anything, no.
He didn't
He didn't leave any papers, or very few. As I said in my opening remarks, it's only because he was very happy to talk about his career to historians whom he trusted to do the right thing with what he said to them, that I was able to talk in the book about what he thought about issues, because there simply are no private papers, there's no correspondence outside his official office materials. So no, I'm sorry, I can't answer that.
So he spoke to you, and did he speak to oral history at the library? Who did he speak to?
Don't think he did one to the library. He did one with the major group. He did with an army officer who was in a short-lived job as command historian here up at Vic Barracks, and there's a series of about 9 or 10 of those from his childhood through to just before he became Chief of the General Staff. He then did two very long ones after his retirement in about 1974 with Ian McNeil, who was the official historian for ground combat operations for Vietnam, and who died about 15 years ago. And those are also on the public record. He had quite a long one with me when I was a mere lad engaged as a graduate student, so this was back in the mid-1980s, on Korea. And then he talked more recently to Garth Pratton, who was has produced a very good book on the exercise of Australian Infantry Battalion Command in the Second World War, and Garth made those available to me too. So there's quite a, it's about this thick of his discussions of everything in his career pretty much, and it's just fortuitous that between us all we got the whole spread of his life and his professional
work. But obviously he didn't talk much about himself, you get the
impression. No, he didn't.
I just want to take it one step further. How many people were you able to talk to about him?
Very few. He died in 2004 at an advanced age. When you outlive all your contemporaries, that's exactly what you do.
Yeah.
So he died at the age of what, 90?
Yes, he was about 91.
So, Stuart?
I think you're getting to the subject that I'm going to... you said that biography is very difficult, and that's because Australians don't keep primary sources along. Now, you write Australian history, so how is that... how is writing Australian history easier than doing biography if primary sources aren't there? Well, you do secondary sources.
No, it's not that primary sources aren't there. Primary sources for much of Australian history are there in abundance, but it's the personal papers. I think one of the things that you come up against very quickly when you're doing a biography, and I've done two general officer biographies over my career, and I'm going to retire now. I'm not going to do any more. But one of the things you come across very quickly is it's not hard, as I said, to work out what happened, but to work out why it happened and why it mattered and what the people who were making the decisions and implementing them thought about it all is very difficult if they don't record it. And Australian public officials, whether secretaries of departments or senior general officers or senior service officers, generally don't keep papers. Now, there are some exceptions, but the big exceptions in that tend to be around the two world wars. And I think there's two things or three things going on there. One, of course, is that particularly for the Great War generation, this was a generation that wrote a hell of a lot. How we're ever going to write sensibly about the soldier experience and view of East Timor or Iraq or Afghanistan, I don't know, because it's all on... Well, I know my father, when he was in Vietnam, used to send back cassettes, and I know what happened to those. It now all goes on, you know, emails or Facebook or whatever, and is completely impermanent. Those earlier generations wrote. The other thing, too, about a lot of those people was that their war service, because that's really what we're talking about, even for quite senior officers, was one of the, if not the, defining experience in their lives. And they went home after it, in many cases. I know from my own family's background, because I come from a tribe of regular army officers, when you move every 2 years, the inclination to toss it out rather than pack it up and carry it and store it, particularly if you're paying for it, because for a long time the services were not particularly generous about removal and storage allowances, is very strong. And I know, again, from my own father's experience, most of the stuff that he generated at various times in his career has long since gone because he couldn't be bothered hauling it around. It's different if you come back to the family home and you don't then move peripatetically every 18 months or 2 years.
Right, have I missed anyone? There's a question here.
Yes. Was he upset or concerned about the treatment of the Vietnam vets by the public and by the government after the war, or the failure to defend them by the government?
Tom was a very circumspect and formal man in a lot of ways, and whilst he had opinions on all sorts of subjects, he generally didn't communicate them outside his intimate circles. So again, you're not doing well with me tonight. I'm going to have to say I can't answer that one either. He was not given to forays into public commentary after his retirement. He comes from that generation, one that had the Official Secrets Act inscribed on its heart, and thought that, you know, what they'd done in service stayed there. And I think also took the view that it was not for retired senior officers of uncertain vintage to teach their successors how to suck eggs when they were long, long out of the context and everything had changed except their memories of how they'd done it. And so he wasn't constantly giving gratuitous advice to his successors about any subject at all.
Well, here I think you can say that this is a precedent that he probably did not pass on to his successors, because a lot of them have become commentators in recent years.
Different context, different media age, apart from anything else.
Did he talk to you at all about the great political figures of his time, like Robert Menzies? Did he have any view?
No, he wouldn't have had much dealings with many of those people. I think you've got to remember that the army was a physically very isolated entity in many ways. It was a rather closed social entity. His predecessor as CGS, Sir John Wilton, was thought by some of his contemporaries to be a little odd because he had civilian friends. And he socialised outside his own network, his own professional army network. The army was a much more insular and closed-off society in those days, and had much less to do with the great and the good, or indeed with anybody very much.
So the relationship with the Air Force and the Navy, was that existent at all?
I think it's probably fair to say that until the abolition of the single service ministries, you had a series of intensely competitive silos or stovepipes that would sometimes come together in uneasy alliances, usually of two against the other one to do them down. They had their own ministers, their own departments, their own secretaries, some of whom were extremely able. Both Gorton and Fraser were in their first ministerial appointments as ministers for the Navy and the Army, respectively, in which they were both regarded as having done a very good job. And that was seen as a forcing house. If you did well, you were obviously going to go on. But it was also somewhere where you could park people who you had to give preferment to. You didn't want to give them anything that was too important. And the service ministries generally qualified for that rather well.
So we're getting to the end. Have I missed anyone? Just come back to the microphone. Have I missed anyone? Going. Oh. Yeah, okay, Robert, yeah.
Hi, so I believe there was a controversy around 1968 when the army was accused of using water torture. Was he involved in how to deal with that?
No. It was dealt with primarily within the task force. The particular episode concerned... there's quite a lengthy account of it in the relevant volume of the official history. And again, it's one of those things, I suppose it sort of reveals a bit where you stand as to whether you think it was overblown or not. But it was dealt with fairly quickly and at a lower level. Right. He wasn't dragged into that one. The ones that tended to get his dander up were things like, around that time, the bastardisation scandal at RMC, which he got particularly upset about because, of course, he was both a graduate and had been on the staff in 1950 as Director of Military Art. And he again felt that there were too many free kicks being given to the criticisms, with a lot of which, I might add, he broadly agreed. But not enough was actually being done to explain the other side and what measures were being taken to deal with this unsatisfactory situation. Misery loves friends, and that tended to be where the reportage concentrated. But it certainly didn't help improve his view of journalism generally.
So just the final question. I mean, you've written this book. Why did you do it, and did you enjoy doing this? But who asked you to do it? What was the experience like, and how much time did you spend talking to Thomas Daly?
Okay, nobody asked me to do it. I did it off my own bat. I'm very suspicious of authorised biographies, and I wouldn't do one. And although the family, meaning principally his eldest daughter, Betty Ann, read the manuscript for me before it went in final form to the press, she was quite clear in her own mind that it was not to vet I was asking her, partly out of a courtesy for her to see what was going to come out, but also just to get her to pick up anything, particularly on the family side, that I might have gotten wrong, because I didn't want to cause offence there. Nobody asked me to do it. I started it actually a long time ago, as I say in the preface, and then various things got in the way, as they do. And finally, I decided a couple of years ago, I was about to go off and start another big project. I thought, I'm never going to be able to do this with a clear conscience unless he's actually out. So I sat down with the resolve that the manuscript would be with Cambridge before I went overseas, which is what finally happened.
And the family, Betty Ann, I think she was a figure in Parliament House. Well, she's on the staff wasn't she? She worked for some Liberal ministers. So what did the family report back?
They were very happy with the book and very pleased to see it come out, which I was very pleased by, but it was not the essential outcome. It was great that it was that way, because I wouldn't have wanted to do anything that would have upset them. But given the sort of man he was, I didn't think it very likely that would ever have been the sort of outcome that I'd have been.
And finally, how was it reviewed in the Australian Army? What did the Australian Army think about this?
Oh, the Australian Army doesn't read books anymore.
We've got a former chief of army down there who's now a learned professor at a learned university.
Well, he was probably
right.
The last one.
Oh, he's the last one. He's the last one to read a book. That was Laurie Shaw's joke, the unionist, and I said to him once, you know, someone gave you a book. He said, this union fellow said to him, why would anyone give me a book? I've already got a book. So the army and the trade union move much the same. Geoffrey, just step aside for a second. I'm very pleased you wrote the book about Tom Daly. He was an important figure in Australian history, and in particular in the Australian Army, but more generally. He ended up having inadvertently a role in a political debate, which he never really wanted. From my very limited correspondence with him, he seemed to be a very decent man, but an important figure, and I think it's great that you've been able to put together this this book. If he was alive today, he'd be just on 100, wouldn't he?
Yes.
So you wrote a book about a figure who was substantially older than you were, but you seem to have got it pretty right, and I think it's a very important work. We're delighted you've been able to come to the Sydney Institute and talk to us tonight. The speech has been recorded on APAC Channel 648 on Foxtel. We've got our podcast here, and we'll publish it in the Sydney papers online, so it will live on as it ought to. But for tonight, thank you.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.